This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 Joycast. In this Joycast, you'll hear a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this Joycast possible. For more information about the music played during the show, please visit the blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of The Fool and the Opera. And no, that's not the usual theme song. We've gone for something that's a little bit Carl Sagan-esque because it's going to be a special episode today. The theme for this episode today is going to be strange couplings, space reimagined, and secular humanism because we're going to be talking about... It's going to be probably the nerdiest, geekiest, most square-shaped episode. And to help me do it, I've got some special guests in the studio. I'm going to introduce them. It's Josh Canal is one of the three masterminds behind the ever-popular TV commentary team that is called The Box Cutters. It's a podcast that you can check out on boxcutters.net, and he's also written for, you know, people like Impress, and he's spoken for people like ABC, and he's here now because he has an interest in opera, and he can talk about things all spacey on TV.
I can really talk about both space and opera in the one sentence and make it sound convincing. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, we've managed to have a quick chat or a long chat before, and yeah, it's true. And on the right hand of the studio, so on the left hand we've got Josh Kennell, on the right hand we've got Adam Christo, who's the host of Flip the Tape. It's Joy's very own sort of indie pop show on Joy, and he's also our resident sci-fi mega nerd.
I'm never getting laid again. Thank you, Dan. No, I kind of feel like you've introduced me a la America's Next Top Models judges. Yeah. Noted fashion photographer, Adam. But I'm cool with that. I'm going to talk about some Vulcans and stuff. We're going to have some fun. And we're going to relate it back to opera in a flimsy way. I'm very excited.
I'm thinking of writing a thesis on noted fashion photographer. I think it's just such a great choice of words.
I agree.
It means so little. You're not going to get laid because of the indie thing or because of the geek thing?
Oh, no. The indie thing counteracts the geek thing.
Oh, okay. So you're even. You're fine.
It's like magnets or something. I don't know.
You're fine.
Well, thank you so much for both joining me. I'm sure in some parallel universe we've done this before. Okay, so let's, we're going to talk a little bit about Carl Sagan, because we thought we'd start with the man who started it for so many people, Carl Sagan. Adam, do you want to tell us a little bit about Carl Sagan?
Yeah, he was my gateway into sci-fi. When I was a little kid, my dad, being the ultimate nerd that he is, he's the sort of person that tapes air crash investigators and watches it religiously. So when we were kids, he would put on Carl Sagan's Cosmos on the old giant VHS tapes and make us watch it.
I can't believe you're outing your dad.
No, my dad's a nerd. He's a nerd proud. He's proud nerd. Okay. He has an iPhone. He plays with it all the time. It's him. But so yeah, he kind of got me into Carl Sagan, who was this massively influential scientist, astronomer, philosopher in a way as well. He was a massive atheist. He would talk about the finite qualities of our planet, our existence, the possibilities of life amongst the stars. It was very exciting. And in many ways, I think he was very influential to science fiction after the 80s. And I think he helped influence things like Star Trek The Next Generation and Babylon 5 and Battlestar Galactica and everything that's sort of come from the 80s onwards. Massively influential guy.
So it's a good place to start, really.
A lot of people would know Sagan as the writer of the book Contact, which was then made into a film with Jodie Foster, where she played a girl who lived in a cave and couldn't speak very well. Oh, no, hang on. I'm mixing them up. turned into a film with Jodie Foster about space exploration and largely about the SETI experiment, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. goes on, and Sagan was a huge driving force in that, and as far as getting people interested in it and getting a new generation of people interested in it as well. And it's his work was very much about, okay, well, what's the next thing? We've conquered the moon. That was always, for centuries and millennia, that was the thing that humans wanted to do. Where do we go next? And just had huge thought processes about what it would be like from far away.
Now, I should just quickly explain why we're doing this space opera special, and it's because Star Trek comes out this week, and it's a film that Adam and I have been able to go see already. And
I'm so jealous.
It was amazing.
So we'll be chatting about things like Battlestar Galactica today. We'll be talking about Star Trek, and of course, as we all know, I do like to keep it a little bit wacky at the start. This week it's not that wacky. We're starting with a track that was written by Vangelis, and we just heard him. He wrote the music for a lot of Carl Sagan's stuff. What was the show in the 80s?
Cosmos.
Thank you. That's the one. And he's also written in 2001. He wrote a piece for the NASA mission to Mars. And so this is Movement 9 from Mythodia, and it's got Kathleen Battle, one of the most well-paid African-American opera singers in the world. And it's a beautiful piece, and it's got a huge collaboration with the London Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, and also the Greek National Ensemble and the Polytomy and Percussion Ensemble. So it's going to be a huge bit of music. I should also make mention of the fact that we've got Nicole Yule coming on later in the show as well. We had an interview with her earlier this week to talk about her upcoming concert, A Gala Night at the Opera, with herself and her husband, Michael Lewis. So we've got that interview coming up later in the show, as I said, but we've also got 3 double passes to give away to that particular performance. So if you want to come along, check out the blog. It's joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera, and just follow the instructions on the blog, and that's your ticket to win some excellent tickets. But of course, as promised, this is going to be Mythodia. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and we just heard Mythodia, which was written by Vangelis, who was a great composer, and he wrote a lot of stuff for Carl Sagan. And we're talking about Carl Sagan and things spacey today, because, Star Trek comes out, and so we thought we'd do a bit of a show about space opera. And I've got 2 special guests in the studio. I've got Adam Christou from Flip the Tape, Josh Cannell from The Box Cutters.
I want to say Vangelis, what a hack. And... because that piece of music, and, you know, obviously I say that jokingly, it's extraordinary, that piece of music. And the fact that there was a soundtrack to a space mission, I think, is quite extraordinary, just in and of itself. But then to get Vangelis to produce such a moving and a piece of music that really identifies the importance of what's going on, and it is a great introduction to the concept of the space opera. Adam, you're really hell-bent on the idea of space opera, and I'm kind of new to it, but really adapting to it very quickly.
I think it's amazing. It's kind of the concept of what happens when a soap opera and science fiction collide, and the two genres kind of get messed up. So instead of having your standalone episodes in your TV narrative, you have long-winding arcs that take years of resolution. You have all these character narratives that play through. You have all these subtle textures in the storyline. It's all about details. It's about a lot of, I guess, loss, love, you know, the classic sort of soap opera narrative, but in a science fiction convention. And I think the first show that really did that successfully was Babylon 5. Back in the 90s, it was incredibly corny. If you go back and look at it now, it's hysterical to kind of watch. It's like really bad wigs, really bad sets, really bad CGI. But the narrative...
The CGI was terrible.
Oh, yeah. It was terrible back then. It looked like a Nintendo, 64 game. It was horrible.
The thing about Babylon 5 is that it is played out on this giant stage. And nothing really says that more than the opening credits, which the name of the creator, Michael J. Stravinsky, appears as a planet turns around and the letters spelling out his name are written the size of the planet. just this whole idea of this is who created it, this is a masterpiece, watch it, enjoy it, appreciate it, understand it, don't mess with it.
And it was a masterpiece considering it had, like, the budget of, I don't know, Neighbours, I suppose. They had, like, three sets that they would constantly redress. And if you've watched the show properly, you can pick out what's going on. They're moving the sofa to the left a little bit. But it was a fantastic show.
And Battlestar Galactica, in terms of the reimagining of it, I think is what we're calling it?
Yes, we'll call it a reimagining.
Yeah. Do you want to sort of tell us a little bit about sort of the way that, you know, it's changed from the original to the new version?
Okay, well, the 70s version, and I know the zombie corpse of Lorne Greene is going to attack me now, wasn't very good. Josh, you're not a big fan.
Lorne Greene? Lorne Greene, he played the head of the family in Bonanza, and then he was the leader in Battlestar Galactica. He was a very famous American television star. He was actually a television star,
right?
Where you know, television just had kind of people who were on it back in the day, because he was in Bonanza, and Bonanza was one of the biggest shows that was around. He became a huge star because of that. So kind of like the Charlton Heston of television, I think,
yeah.
Lorne Greene. And Bonanza and Battlestar Galactica combined, it's a very interesting idea because it brings together the concept of the Western and the science fiction story. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about Star Trek a little bit later on, but that was the original intention. In fact, Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, when he pitched the story to the network, he actually pitched it as Bonanza in Space.
Right.
That was actually part of the pitch. So Lorne Greene is very important in the whole Battlestar Galactica space opera.
And he's going to hate me now because I'm going to trash out the original Battlestar. It wasn't good.
No, it's terrible.
It was kind of like Star Wars for the small screen. Here's some really camp stuff going on. Let's all have cigars.
It was really cheaply made. And the new Battlestar Galactica, though, is just a mind-blowing television experience. You talk about the long story and stories going over several series. New Battlestar Galactica just has all of that and has all of the huge themes that you would expect from opera. It has the concept of odyssey, the concept of exile, the concept of illness and survival and immortality and going through hell, and all those things that we see played out in operas over and over again. They're really a major part of Battlestar Galactica. It is, I think, a perfect example of space opera.
And to tie it back into the Western, you've also got that sort of, like, the wagon trail of the stars, where all these people are sort of, like, going to try and find a new home, and it's like an outcast sort of... It's very fascinating.
And opera sort of features quite literally in the plot of Battlestar Galactica at some point.
Yeah,
as well,
there's the Kobol Opera House, where prophetic visions that the president sees while she's high. Spoilers. while she's high off her face. Basically,
she's legitimately high. She's suffering from cancer.
She's suffering from cancer, so she's taking magical cancer pills. Right. And so she's having a fun adventure in her mind, and she goes to the opera house, and she sees prophetic visions which play out in the narrative of the show. So the idea of the opera house, of the theater, the stage of these great dramatic moments, and it plays through to the finale of the show. Absolutely stunning how they use that idea of the theater and the theater set in their narrative and sort of bring it in. And then I suppose music in the show is amazing as well, because it crosses from being a score to being an actual narrative element towards the end of the series. And I don't want to spoil it, but songs actually play a very valid importance to the mythos of the show as you go on.
Right. And the next aria that we're going to play is from Battlestar Galactica. And apparently it's not that important a scene in the show itself.
Yeah, it was just like a minor West Wing type scene where they were doing politics and they had like a drink sort of function, and the president was kind of like wining and dining people, and this sort of opera track plays in the background.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is the English translation from Italian. has some sort of prophetic sort of stuff about the plot that up until this point in season one, the audience don't actually know is going on with the storyline. So it's kind of like an Easter egg surprise. It's sort of giving away secrets of season two.
Or it's a foretelling in a kind of opening moment,
right.
Like you would have in a regular opera.
So do you guys just mind reading out some of the lyrics? Because it's kind of funny that, as well when you translate it from the Italian.
Woe upon your Cylon heart, there's a toaster in your head. And it wears high heels, number six calls to you.
I think that's fantastic because, you know, when we're talking about the foretelling, the idea that, and this is about Gaius Balfour, who is one of the major players in the Cylon revolution, essentially, and he's kind of an unwitting player, and he has a Cylon who is almost entirely imaginary. She doesn't exist. She speaks to him. No one else sees her in the room. It's very awkward in that way, and we don't know that at this stage. When this opera song plays, we don't know that she's not real. We also don't know that she is number six, which implies that there are other Cylons. So if you take the time to investigate and translate, you learn a lot about the series very early on.
Well, this is Battlestar Operatica. It's from Battlestar Galactica. And it's because it's on the Fool and the Opera today because we're talking about space opera, where sci-fi and opera meet. This is the Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. You're on the Fool of the Opera on Joy 94.9, and we just heard Battlestar Operatica. And it's a... if you understand Italian, the lyrics are quite funny. If you don't, I will have the English translation on the blog for you. It's the joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera. There's a toaster in your head, Adam. What does that mean?
Oh, man. Okay. The Cylons are actually slang called toasters because the original Cylon models looked like they had a chrome toaster head. And if you've seen the original Battlestar Galactica, they kind of look like toaster men. I mean, how else to explain it other than that?
They do. They look like toasters. Even as much as they have a red glowing slot. So, you know, if that was open, you could put bread in there and cook it, which is fantastic. And the toaster motif is hilarious. I was at the NBC store in New York a little while ago, and they actually have Battlestar Galactica branded toasters for sale in the store.
I think I need one. I really do.
It is a space opera special on the Fool and the Opera. In the right corner, I've got Adam Christed from Flip the Tape, and in the left corner, I've got Josh Cannell from the Boxcutters.
Space opera. It's all. It's all television. It's because we haven't really seen much that we could really call space opera in the realm of film. There are kind of hints to it here and there, mostly. In Star Trek films.
Very much. And, you know, this segues us perfectly to the new Star Trek film that's coming out, the 11th film, which I'm going to be a bit honest. Unfortunately, it's not in depth like some of the previous Star Trek films when it talks about, I suppose, emotional complexity and sort of political and social issues. It kind of glosses over that slightly. And I think that's for the better in this case because while the series could handle it really well, the movies kind of dragged on when they went to some places that were incredibly... that didn't quite work in a filmic sense. I mean, you've got 2.5 hours at the most to tell a good story. If you bog it down, it's not going to work. The new Star Trek film is, I suppose, very sleek, and that's why it works in the strongest way possible. And it is a rebooting, which is a word I know you hate for franchises.
I do, but it does make sense, I think... from what I've heard of this Star Trek film, but explain, why would it be a rebooting rather than just a reimagining?
Well, this is a literal rebooting in the sense that you have the space-time continuum of the original Star Trek disrupted and altered by a Romulan time-traveling vessel, which is manned by Eric Banner, who's looking quite angry and has facial tattoos. It's very rough trade. And so he's gone back in time and completely altered the world of Star Trek and rebooted the franchise into an alternate universe.
I love the idea of space rough trade. That's hilarious.
And that Eric Banner would be space rough trade. Very appropriate.
So they go. So that's quite a mind mess, you know, to deal with a lot more than Back to the Future. The concept is, again, it follows through these themes that we see in opera of encountering your past and bring it back to where it's supposed to be, and trying to find yourself and learning identity, learning about your own identity. I think that's extraordinary.
And that's definitely one of the core themes of the movie. It's all about, you know, Spock and Kirk discovering who they are and that initial friendship, and which is one of the most important elements of the Star Trek original series and those pivotal Star Trek movies from the 70s and 80s, was the relationship between Kirk and Spock as characters and how they grew. So definitely, yeah, that's one of the main elements of the new series. But thankfully, although it plays with time, they don't do the corny reset button. The changes are permanent. It's very exciting. They don't go out that boring element way.
That's great. And I think the story of Kirk and Spock is one of the great kind of romances of the genre.
It's gay.
It is an unrequited romance. I mean, they have such huge respect for one another, and it, you know, to top it off, as if it wasn't hard enough that they were both men in the 70s. The idea that that one of them is a Vulcan or a half Vulcan who is entirely logical and really tries to push away any emotion he's going to have. That's the fantastic makings of a romance story, and it really plays out in Star Trek, which is great to see, and culminates in this wonderful moment where in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, you're bowing down. It is a great, film. And it finishes with Spock, and again, spoiler, sorry, but Spock has to actually sacrifice himself and says to Kirk, to explain it, the need of the many outweighs the need of the few.
Mm.
And that really just drives the concept home of everything that they've gone through together and everything that they're trying to do. And it is this huge storyline.
And you're talking about this before, and this is the moment where you kind of get teary, isn't it?
It is a very lump in the throat moment in science fiction.
Dust fills the room. You can't help but welt up a little bit, but you know, it's a dusty breeze.
It's a dusty breeze moment. You know what? I'm chopping onions at the time. It is hard to deal with. Yeah, but Star Trek is perfect for looking at opera and science fiction combined. I've just remembered another great kind of operatic thing in Star Trek. In Star Trek Next Generation, there is a character called Q, who is essentially Mephisto. Like, he is the devil. He is there for tempting. He is there to turn everything on its head. He is there to kind of help people prove their own worth. Again, you just have these huge themes that run through a lot of these shows, and Star Trek Next Generation, the Q episodes were pretty... There were four episodes a season that were actually worth watching in Star Trek Next Generation. There were the Q episodes and the Data Discovers More About Himself.
Oh no. Episodes. No. I'm sorry. Some of the Data episodes are just horrible. Like Data Learns to Paint. I don't want to watch Data learning to paint.
But that's the thing about identity.
Paint
by
numbers.
Well, he is a robot. So, but you know, the whole storyline of Data is about learning who you are, especially in the face of being an outsider. And you don't get more opera than that.
I will give you this, because I just don't like the Geordi falls in love episodes or the Riker's accused of sleeping with an alien woman episodes. You know, those.
For me, once Tasha Yar died, the whole series was dead to me. So,
wow, that's when it jumped the shark for you.
For me,
Tasha
right
Yar
there.
Dies from the slime monster.
Yep, first series.
All right, let's. Adam, I'd like you to explain Klingons and Klingon opera.
Okay, the Klingons are like they're kind of like the warrior race of Star Trek. And it's kind of an in-joke after a while. They're meant to be this strong, proud warrior race where honor is the most important value. And a lot of it's taken from feudal Japan's history with samurais and that sort of samurai warrior culture. So there's an in-joke in Star Trek about Klingon opera being the most beautiful and poignant culture and art that's come out of the Klingon kind of culture. And it's absolutely horrible. It's the most painful thing you'll ever hear. And I think it's kind of a slight jab at atonal operas such as Chinese opera. And kind of a nerdy reference, I suppose.
All right. Well, we're going to play a bit of Klingon opera on the station, on The Fool and the Opera. And we'll follow it up, actually, with a very interesting piece. It's Amok Time, and it was done by a group of people who basically played Star Trek on a big screen and then sang in opera in synchronicity with it, which is quite amazing. So we'll play that back to back. Just quickly want to make mention of the fact that we do have an interview with Nicole Yule coming up later in the show as well. So you're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and we're talking things spacey, so therefore we just had the introduction to Star Trek, Amok Time, the Opera. And I've got some special guests in the studio today. I've got Adam Christou from Flip the Tape, and I've got Josh Cannell from...
Box Cutters is what you're looking for, boxcutters.net, podcast all about television. Can I say, that is the dumbest thing I've ever seen / heard. Probably all year. We're in May now. Probably all year. People singing opera about Star Trek in front of projected Star Trek episode. Why? That's why. I don't know. It somewhere you've got a theory on this, Adam. You've got a theory that someone applied for a grant and they accidentally got it? Is that...
Yeah, that's what I think's happened. And then that grant mysteriously would have been used on substances that may have influenced the creation of this fabulous work of art.
Or gone into the payment for that saw.
Yeah, the singing saw was fantastic and probably the most talented highlight of the Amok Time.
The singing saw comes in for the start of the Star Trek theme. And something I noticed a few years ago watching an old episode of Star Trek, because sometimes that is what I used to do with my spare time, is how similar the start of the original theme of Star Trek is to the start of The Phantom and the Opera.
Right.
Have a listen to it, not when people are singing over it in a bad opera, but have a listen to it on your own, do a compare and contrast, then send an email to Dan, let him know whether or not I'm full of crap.
Yeah. You can do that at onair@joy.org.au.
Yep, you certainly can. Or, you know, just the Fool and the Opera at joy.org.au as well. We'll probably take it by there. I don't know why.
Take it any way you can.
Yeah, pretty much. So, well, we're running out of time, so we're going to have to wrap it up very soon.
But I've only just started talking crap.
I want to make up more stuff.
I've loved this whole idea of science fiction, space adventure being opera, because I'd never really thought about the two before. I think, Adam, you were saying off air that you've thought about this concept quite a bit.
Yeah, but more in the constraints of soap opera as a television genre meshing into, I suppose, science fiction as a television genre. Not so much the art of opera and opera theatre and how it relates to science fiction. So putting those two together and marrying those two concepts was quite fascinating.
And just seems to fit so well. So I'm loving this. It's like just diving into the deep end and discovering that, oh, I can swim.
And you're telling us before that you're really enjoying it as well, because you always wanted to do it on the box cutters, or you always tried to, and you kind of...
I do. I try to look as deeply as possible into the subtext, the genre of television shows. And Brett and John, my fellow box cutters, just look at me as if I am full of crap. And I really love doing this. I love the exploration and the whole concept that there is no single genre. Everything ties in together and everything is related in some way or another. The idea of looking at Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica as operas, albeit, you know, largely without song, they still have all the same elements of the metadrama that we see in standard opera.
Let's talk very quickly about the box cutters.
Sure.
You guys have just had your 180th episode.
That's right. Last week we recorded episode 180, which means next week 181. It's a palindrome episode. Ooh. Only get them one every 10. And it's great. We've been going for almost 4 years. It is a show entirely about television and looking at television. Basically, it came out of a discussion we were having that television, for no good reason, doesn't get the same respect that film, literature, theatre does. And it should, because it is telling these amazing stories. And when you look at the good television, it's some of the best stuff that is out there for entertainment value. When you look at the bad television, well, you can also look at the bad theatre, you can look at the bad films, you can look at the bad books. There's plenty of that everywhere.
And the bad operas, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And projection screens of Star Trek.
Oh, that's terrible.
And I've got to ask you this. How many people have you killed on the box cutters now?
This started, the whole killing people, and I don't mean to do it. Anytime that I do it, I don't mean to do it, but you can't help but talk about people who used to be in television and are now very old. That happens sometimes. It started off with me talking about TV shows and saying that they weren't long for this world, and then the next night it would be announced that they were cancelled. Then it went into me talking about Grant Hackett and how he had definitely retired from swimming. And then the next day he holds a press conference saying that he's retiring from swimming. And I just assumed that he had done that because he had all these other things. And then one day I announced that Eartha Kitt had died, which is going to make, I think, all the Joy listeners hate me. But I heard on the radio, I thought I heard that she had died that day. She hadn't. It was a huge mistake. I corrected it in the episode just so people weren't going away going, oh, the kid died. I thought I would have heard about that. Well, yeah. So I did correct it in the episode, did some very quick research. 2 weeks later, Eartha Kitt dead. And I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to, but it happened.
And Adam's got another one as well.
Yeah, you killed B. Arthur, didn't you?
A few weeks ago, and this is really more like a couple of months ago, I was talking about Maud and the Golden Girls in relation to the old TV show Soap, which Soap, based on soap opera, brings us back to this. And so, you know, mention those shows and probably mention B. Arthur in passing. Brett Cropley would have you believe that when I actually mentioned that, because it was so long ago, that's actually the point where she got cancer. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but look, I'm sorry for... I did mention Angela Lansbury a couple of weeks ago, and so far, still alive.
Okay.
We'll be on Angela watch, I reckon. I have a request, though. Since you have the ability to cancel television shows, it will. Bondi Vet, any way you can kind of stop that show from happening, or, just reference it on the box cutters?
Doesn't work that way. It's like telling someone you wish. As soon as you do that, it's gone forever.
So it's going to be on for 10 seasons. He's going to be Cleo Bachelor of the Year for the next 10 years. I've just created a nightmare, haven't I?
Yeah, pretty much.
And we should just quickly mention Brett Cropley is the third member of
John Box Cutters. Yes, John Brett, and me.
Yeah.
I love doing the show. I love exploring a medium that way. It's a lot of fun.
I too explore a medium. A different medium.
I didn't want to say something like that.
But oh, no, I've done. I've created the most horrible segue possible, but I did it. You can also tune in to me, Adam, on Flip the Tape on Friday afternoons, 2 p.m., 4 p.m.
I love that you wave.
I know. That's because there's cameras in here. You're just not sure where they are.
There aren't any.
But they're here. Oh, yes, there are. But so, yes, I'm waving. You can tune in to me on 2 p.m., 4 p.m. Fridays on Joy 94.9 for Flip the Tape, which is my indie eclectic radio show, where I play songs and back announce them, which I think has never been done on radio before. It's quite exciting. You may hear me talk about the songs and what title they are, and then I might play another song after that.
So what sort of music are we talking about?
This week, we actually have actually it would have already aired, so edit this out of the podcast. And this week, I might be looking at some stuff from the new Snob Skrilla. I'm potentially going to be looking at, shoegaze and lo-fi music, which are two of my favorite genres. And apparently we should start a Flip the Tape drinking game because I say it at least 5 times an episode. So there's some good, take a shot when Adam says shoegaze. Go right ahead.
And you've played some interesting music that I really, have said to you so many times that I really enjoy it. You played, a bit of Queen, Night at the Opera, and it was a new version of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, it wasn't quite Queen's version. It was the Flaming Lips covering it. So I think that's kind of a sacred song for Queen fans. I'm not a huge fan of Queen, so when the Flaming Lips come in and decide to do a psychedelic tripped out version of it and absolutely pay homage to it in the best way possible, I'm a fan.
Queen have a huge relationship to opera because Freddie Mercury was trained as an opera singer, and they have a Night at the Opera. But then they also did, and this brings it back to the sci-fi theme. They did the soundtracks to Flash Gordon and Highlander, and have very. The soundtrack to Flash Gordon is hugely operatic, and they also did a song in the Giorgio Moroder opera version of Metropolis, the old science fiction film. So a huge opera band,
right.
Queen.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to finish the show with that then. So before we go, I'd like to hear your websites just once more.
Boxcutters.net.
joy.org.au/flip the tape.
Well, Josh Cannell from The Boxcutters and Adam Christou from Flip the Tape, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been exciting. I can't wait to come back again and talk crap. Thank you.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and that was, of course, Flash Gordon, as done by Queen, from the Greatest Hits album, which is quite an album. You should definitely check it out. There is definitely some very operatic moments there. Now, as I've been promising, we've got an interview with Nicole Yule. It was wonderful to speak with her. For me, it was a little bit of an exciting moment when I realized that she actually listened to the program as well. So if you're listening right now, Nicole, hello. As I said earlier, we do have 3 double passes to give away to a gala night at the Opera, which Nicole will be performing at with her husband, Michael Lewis, and also Rosario Laspina. So they'll be performing some excellent music. There'll be Wolf Wagner, a bit of Bizet, Verdi, and also the first act of Tosca. And it's all being done as part of the Robert Blackwood Hall concert series. So if you want some excellent music to go see, check out the blog. It's joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera. In the meantime, here are the interview highlights with my interview with Nicole Yule. Nicole Yule is one of the finest sopranos in Melbourne and indeed Australia. Recently the lead in the Melbourne production of Moffat Oxenbould's Madame Butterfly. She's back in town to sing as Floria Tosca with the Monash Academy Orchestra as part of the Robert Blackwood Hall series. Thanks for joining me, Nicole.
Pleasure.
It sounds like this is going to be quite a night. You'll be singing with your husband, of course. Another pairing of Tosca and Scarpia.
There's a couple of us around.
Yeah. As Tosca, do you find Scarpia's, their potential husband material?
I don't know. Cavaradossi doesn't do it for me, I got to say. No, look, even when I was going through college and all that, the interest was there in the more baritonal sort of voice to start with, even though I had a few little off things happens with tenors, but we can't speak of that. no baritones all the way. But Scarpia, the character, he's mesmerizing. He's just mesmerizing, so charismatic, so evil, but sexy with it. I love it. Sorry, I love Scarpia.
Well, in this particular concert, the first half will be a concert of different songs and different arias, and then the second half is just going to be the first half of Tosca.
That's right. Yeah, we're doing the whole of the first act. We've got the wonderful Rosario Lispina coming in to do the cover of Ossie's. So, yeah, it'll be like meeting up with old friends again. And because we've done Butterfly together, myself and Rosario. And Michael, of course, has done Rigoletto with Rosario. So we all know each other very well. And really looking forward to making some glorious music because that stuff is amazing music.
Absolutely. And in terms of the reason why this concert series happens is a lot of it is to do with mentoring, and it's part of the training process for the students of the Monash Academy of Performing Arts.
Yeah, they say that they want to get some of us oldies in to let the kids have a listen to how it's supposed to be done. I'm not so sure about that. I've been there, done that as a student myself, and geez, there's some good kids that can play and that can sing in these orchestras and in the institutions down there. And you know, being a Melbourne girl, I've seen a bit of it, and I think we're very lucky down there.
Mm, you're a VCA girl, and your teacher was Dame Joan Hammond.
Yeah, same as Cheryl and Peter. There's a few of us that have come out of there. No, she was a great teacher, and no, there's quite a handful of us, and we're out there working, and yeah, we have a bit of the old Hammond imprint, I'm sure.
So what does that mean to have the Hammond imprint? Is it the way you sing?
There's a certain sound, I think, that you can sort of hear and say, oh, you can just hear a bit of Joan in there, you know. She was a top lady, yeah.
In terms of your voice, you sing quite a bit of Puccini. I mean, you've done all the great Puccini roles. It's Mimi, Chocho, and Tosca.
Yeah, not bad, huh? I'm a pretty lucky girl.
Well, I was going to say, like, how many times have you died now on stage?
Oh, I tell you what, too many times for my knees, that's for sure. It's either dying or praying it does your knees in bad. But no, I've died quite a few times, and I nearly died once for real.
Oh, really?
Not really, I exaggerate, but I was doing Liu in Turandot, and all girls previous to me that had done the death had taken the blade, taken the sword, and sort of run it along the side of their body as they turned up stage. A little trick. I decided to go front in, and of course I was a last-minute replacement on this occasion. Oh, no, second cast I was. And I got the dagger and plunged it in and thought, that hurt a bit. Got out, my costume had been torn. The dagger had gone through my skin and I've still got the scar from it just below my rib cage because they'd never blunted the damn thing because all the girls had gone to the side. They didn't feel the need to.
Oh, my God, that would have been a rush to the hospital.
Oh, it's now blunt.
Yeah. Well, so I've heard of Scarpias being sent to hospital for being cut up by Tuskers.
Oh, that's a pretty dangerous role for it, you've got to admit. Especially when I heard, now was it on your show that I heard Cheryl had said that she'd plunged it in numerous times or something with great joy? I actually did Tosca when Cheryl went sick once. I was her understudy, and I actually did it with Peter, which was quite interesting. I mean, that must have been very interesting for him,
right.
to have been performing with his wife, and all of a sudden here's this strange girl plunging at him in different ways.
So is there a stabbing technique that you need to use? Like,
you'd like to think that there was. I'm not so sure. Oh, look, you know, you're up there and you've got things to sing in around that time, and you've got, you know, moments, chords, specific moments that you have to plunge it in and things like this, and, you know, the baritone's got to be on a bit of a wing and a prayer.
Now, in terms of your repertoire, as we said, Puccini is quite strong, but you've also got Verdi and also Wagner as well, which I found quite surprising, because usually Puccini and Wagner women are kind of on opposite ends of the scale, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, but, you know, look, I don't have a lot of Wagner. I've done Elsa, again, just as a last-minute step-in, very last-minute step-in, like for, I think it was a 6 o'clock show, and I got the call up at 4:30 in the afternoon, which was, you know, it was the last show, so I thought, done and dusted. Never relax, Dan, never relax. And so I've done Elsa and Lohengrin. And at this concert, actually, in Monash, I'll be doing the Liebestod from Tristan and Isolde, which will be my first time doing that, and I'm really looking forward to that, because that is orgasmic music. Mm-hmm. And, but you know, Puccini is where my voice sits really well now, Verdi the same, and Wagner is, you know, at the moment a little bit experimental, but... who knows? You know, it's a time thing with Wagner, isn't it?
Mm.
You don't want to do that stuff too early.
And in terms of your voice, you've been described as sort of mezzo-ish soprano, is what I've got written down.
Have you?
Yeah.
That's actually quite nice. I like that. No, I like that because, you know, I've always wanted to be a mezzo because they get the really nice, meaty roles and, you know, they're a bit of a bitch sometimes and they cause all the trouble and you don't have to sing so high. That might make me lazy, I don't know. Look, I like being a soprano, but I like getting, as I call it, down and dirty. I like singing bottom notes. It's great fun.
Do you end up learning something from the students themselves when you are singing with them?
Oh, yeah. I did a gig a few years ago now. I did Guru Leader. With Schoenberg's Guru Leader with the AYO, Australian Youth Orchestra. Oh, those kids were... We had a very good conductor. Oh, I've forgotten his name now, Diego. He was a wonderful conductor and was able to talk on such a level with the kids. And they loved him. And just, it's mainly the enthusiasm. And it just sort of... You know, sometimes in this business you can get a little bit jaded by things and just to get back to the grassroots of loving what they do can be really rewarding.
The Fool and the Opera. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you so much for tuning in and sticking around. I hope you enjoyed the Space Opera special as well as the interview with Nicole Yule. Thank you so much to my other guests as well, Adam Christou from Flip the Tape and Josh Cannell from The Box Cutters. Remember, you can check out the blog for all the latest updates in what's happening in opera. That is joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera. Remember to check out the blog and, of course, follow through the links to go into the draw for the tickets to Night at the Opera, a gala night at the opera, rather, with Nicole Yule and Michael Lewis and Rosario Lespina. It'd be an excellent night of music, so definitely do take up that offer. I should also make mention of the fact, while we were speaking of space this week, the Petri Dish, who are on Tuesdays. The Petri Dish, it's on Tuesdays at 10 o'clock. It's got Shane and Wendy and, of course, Kane as well. And it's Science Under the Microscope. And this week, Under the Microscope, is going to be space. So if you like your space opera, if you like the theme from this week, well, definitely check out their show because they'll be talking about all the things that you like as well. So that's coming up this week on Joy 94.9. And coming up now, stick around for Bent Notes. It's going to be a great night of jazz music. So stick around, Kirsten, with Bent Notes. Until next week, when we have our Eurovision special, I'll see you next week. Same Fledermaus time, same Fledermaus channel.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert. Thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.